Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Podcasting from the top of the rocks. This is News on the Rocks with Patty Steele.
Well, today we are sipping as we begin News on the Rocks with, we started with blackberry vodka, and it sounds really creepy, but it actually wasn't. It's a company called, let's see, what is it? Core. And it actually is really good because it wasn't like remarkably sweet. It just has the essence of the, black raspberry, sorry. And, but we discovered very quickly that we have a lot of drinkers in the room and we ran out. So now we have moved on to some Patron Añejo tequila, which is making all of us very happy. And that's kind of how we get things going. You know, I've had a couple of conversations with you, Paul Barr, that have like really lit me up. The first time I heard of you and heard you was in some commercials that were running for your law firm, in which you talked about how you represent people who were abused as children, sexually abused as children, whether it was by someone in a school, church, whatever it was. But the thing that really set you apart to me was that you had been through this yourself. And I thought, wow, you know, there's something, it's kind of like if you've had cancer, it's really great if the doctor can relate to you either because they've had something like that or they've had an, you know, some kind of an illness in which you feel like they feel what you're going through. And so we spoke at length one day and I just was completely amazed at the modesty with which you addressed what you've done and what you're doing now. So thank you for coming
in. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me here today and you're welcome.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I'm gonna kind of get everybody up to date as to what Paul is all about. He's an attorney who started his adult life as a firefighter after college.
No, actually,
sort of before college.
Before college, yes.
Okay.
And during.
Uh-huh. And then you were a battalion chief. I know you won an award for heroism for rescuing a little boy from an apartment fire. Then you went on to get your college degree. You've got a master's in education.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
You taught at-risk students in Niagara Falls. And now you have a law degree. You've had a law degree for, what, 20 years or so?
20 years, yes.
Yeah, which led him to help victims of child sex abuse. And he knows that world really well because he himself was molested by a parish priest when he was just 16 years old. You are the definition of a Renaissance man.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you are. It's really, you know, it's funny because I talked to you about this and you said, well, you know, you were kind of playing it down. You said, well, you know, I also make money from this. But to me, the greatest thing in the world is if you can make an income doing something that really helps other people. And that's what you've done all your life. Firefighter, you're an attorney who reaches out to people who have been victimized and you help them regain a sense of empowerment. And that's an incredibly beautiful story. Can you tell us your story and where this began as a kid?
As a kid, I grew up in Niagara Falls, mm-hmm. New York. And I guess the very beginning of this is sort of autobiographical. The very beginning is I was adopted mm-hmm. into a working class family. My father was a factory worker. Mm-hmm. My mother stayed at home. Yeah. And I went to public schools in Niagara Falls, but we were a Catholic family. My grandmother was the matriarch of the family and insisted that I attend Mass every week. Mm-hmm. My parents did not regularly attend. Right. My father wasn't Catholic. Right. My mother was a Christmas and Easter Catholic.
A lapsed Catholic.
Yeah, pretty much, yes. Yeah, yeah. But But my grandmother would come and pick us up every Sunday morning, my brother and me. I had one brother, and we would go to Mass at Sacred Heart Church in Niagara Falls.
So she was kind of your rock as far as your religious upbringing.
She was the one making sure that we were dotting our I's and crossing our T's and making the sign of the cross.
Yeah.
That was the Catholic part of us, but mm-hmm. it was really the core
right.
of our identity.
Sure. It's not just a spiritual thing, but also a social and cultural kind of a thing.
Yeah, we found reasons to be at our church frequently, whether it was for a social event. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was had so many friends there.
Sure.
So we were always attending something at church, whether it was bingo or whatever fun thing there was.
Yeah, dinners
was
and I know.
Sure. So I had some tragic events before my involvement with right. the priest that took advantage of me.
Right.
And I think that those events earlier are what this priest and other people like him mm-hmm. can zero, they zero in on somebody.
They see vulnerability.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. And I have some clients who've been victimized numerous times, and it becomes almost implausible. Like, how could one person have had all these different people, they have all these different claims, and maybe three priests abuse them.
Right.
And my response is, it's simple. Yeah. Whatever the first priest saw, the second priest saw that, plus the fact that this guy was already now further damaged. So this girl was further damaged.
And insecure and vulnerable and not understanding what the role they played in it was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So here I was at 16.
Yeah.
Still, in a sense, reeling over some, as I said earlier, teenage events. Mm-hmm. And this priest sees me coming to Mass with my grandma.
Yeah.
And knows that my parents aren't really there, doesn't really care why, but just knows that I'm in the front row with grandma.
And there's some fragile fingers there that he sees.
Yeah, and I'm hanging around after Mass to ask him questions.
Sure.
I want to know a little bit about theology. I want to know a little bit about end-of-life stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I want a mentor.
Yeah.
So I stick around. I talk to this guy. He says...
Popular guy in the church?
Well, this particular priest was... I wouldn't describe him as that.
Oh, really? He was a little more reserved?
He wasn't so full of charisma.
Oh, wow.
Like some of the others that I know. But
right.
Because I was so hungry for something.
Yeah. And he was there to answer those questions.
He was there.
Yeah.
He was there. And he picked up on my I guess, vulnerability, fragility.
Of course.
And he invites me to, hey, we're going to start a youth group. Let's start a youth group for the kids who have already made their confirmations, mm-hmm. Which we did in 10th grade.
Right.
And he says, you're so athletic and good looking, mm-hmm. and the girls all like you, and everyone looks up to you. None of which was true.
I doubt that. You're gorgeous now.
No,
why weren't you then?
No, none of it. But I wanted it to be true. I was.
We all do. I know the feeling. Yeah.
So that kind of flattery, it puffs up your peacock feathers, and
yeah.
he says, hey, why don't you come by? I want you to stop by the rectory, and we'll talk this over.
Okay.
So that'd be great.
Yeah.
So I remember specifically, and this is kind of important. I remember convincing my mother that I should be allowed to drive the car to church, although I didn't have my night license yet. But I said, because it's church, Ma, though, they won't give me a ticket because you're allowed to drive to church and to work.
Right.
So I she's like, well, okay. I get there and I go in and he invites me in and he's happy to see me and hands me a beer.
Huh.
I'm 16.
Yeah, so, you're a baby.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't think I'm a baby. I think I'm a big shot because I got
a
beer.
Yeah, you got a beer, and it's okay because it's from a priest.
Yeah, so I'm drinking with Father Mike, and not like today.
I'm sorry.
So we go in, we start to talk, and drinking this beer, and he's the whole time flattering me, saying, what sport do you do? And he's touching me, like, feeling my arm, squeezing them, and mm-hmm. he says, you're a big, strong guy. You need to really be careful because, athletes like you, you can get injured. What sport do you play? And I said, well, I'm a wrestler. I'm going to be captain next year of the team.
Wow.
And I'm only a junior.
Yeah.
He says, wow, that's great. Well, you need to be careful because these injuries, you know, you can become sterile.
Oh, my God. Here we go.
And like, well, okay. Because you know what that means? I said, yeah, I know what that means. Having been adopted, my mother couldn't have kids. And
right.
He says, well, you don't want that. You want children someday, right? I said, well, yeah, of course. He says, well, early detection, that's the important part.
Oh, my God.
You know, as a military chaplain, he goes, I've got special training. I know how to detect these conditions. It's a simple thing. He goes, why don't you let me check you out? I said, I'm good. No, thank you. My mother will take me to the doctor.
Right.
He rather insistent, he stood up, he walks over, pushes my shoulders back, lays me onto the couch. Next thing you know, I'm being examined. My pants.
But not
are,
really.
Oh, no, I'm not really. My pants are around my knees and you know, instantly I knew bad touch.
Right.
And I panicked. I got up. And this was an old brownstone rectory. And I remember...
Oh, sounds creepy.
It was creepy. I remember grabbing the door to leave, and it was locked from the inside.
Holy crap. Sorry. That's not... Holy crap. Wow. Sorry.
So he reaches his pocket. He pulls out a skeleton key. And this is, you know...
This is like a movie.
Survivors have... vivid recollections.
It's like burned in your brain, isn't
of
it?
The weirdest details.
Yeah.
And when you say it sounds like a movie, I just watched again the movie Spotlight.
Yeah.
And in the film,
what a movie.
One of the survivors is being interviewed, and the survivor in that film recalls just a detail.
Right.
Not relevant to what happened, but just a detail. And I looked at my wife and I go, that's what they do. That's what we do. We all remember certain
that moment
details that aren't relevant to what was happening, but it's burned into your brain. And I remember the skeleton key. And he let me leave. He opened the door, obviously.
Right.
Let me,
what did he say to you?
He just said very calmly, which was creepy, very calmly. He says, you can go. It's okay. And he patted me on the shoulder and I scurried out. And I went home.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, I told my mother.
Right. Oh, well, that's good that you felt comfortable to at least tell her.
Well, yes and no, because her response to me was, how could you be so naive?
Oh.
And
I think of my own sons and I want to hug you because I feel I understand that innocence. You look like a man, but you're not a man at that age.
Right. At 16, you're certainly
you're a baby.
You're still a child.
Yeah.
And she said, don't tell Dad because God knows what he might do and
right. We
need him
right.
to provide for our family.
Right.
So basically don't tell anybody.
Oh, that's so damaging. We know that now. Maybe we didn't know it then as well, but.
No.
So what happened then?
So I didn't tell anybody. She said I didn't have to go to church for a while. For a while. So I didn't go to church for a while.
What'd you tell your grandmother?
I didn't tell her anything. I didn't tell anybody else anything.
Yeah, and she was okay with you not going.
Yeah, I don't know what she told her.
Right, you're right. Oh, yeah, there's
I don't know
the backstory.
but it was left there.
Yeah.
But the tragedy of this, besides that part of it and how it affected my relationship with my mother.
Right, sure.
The tragedy is within weeks, the very summer, my wrestling coach invites me over and tells me I need to be in shape and work out. And
he sees the vulnerability too.
I mean,
these are predators who look at children and find that vulnerable child.
That's right. And he had already been, you know, in grooming, as they say.
Right.
He would drive me home for practice.
He didn't know the priest at all.
Didn't know the priest. No relationship. It was you would call it a coincidence.
He saw the same gentleness, the same vulnerability, and thought he could take advantage.
And he tried and invited me over. And long story short, pinned me down and tried to molest me.
Right.
Fortunately for me, at that moment, he was drunk enough that I could fight him off.
Right. And you were a wrestler. So
I think he half let me go.
All right.
Because he was a very talented athlete.
Yeah.
But I got away and he convinced me not to tell anybody.
Right. Did he threaten you or did
No, he convinced me because he appealed to my liberal
team spirit.
Yeah, team spirit. Yeah, maybe and my liberal ideology
that
I couldn't have explained then, but he knew that I would keep a secret. I didn't care about what his, you know, he said, I wouldn't have done this if I only did it because I thought you wanted me to. And please understand.
Of course, blame the victim as opposed to taking responsibility for yourself and your, wow.
So I kept his secret, but.
What happened to him?
He molested more children.
Wow.
And went to prison.
Wow.
And died in prison.
Wow.
And as I grew older, that's what motivated me to report the priest.
Yeah.
Because I felt so guilty that I hadn't reported the coach. I did not have the courage as a young person to report that coach.
Right.
And I felt guilty because I thought I could have prevented some of these other victims.
It's a really interesting part of the psychology of being victimized by people. And we're going through that now with like the Harvey Weinstein case and other people say, well, why didn't you do blah, blah, blah? There is a part of being victimized that makes you feel so weak that you don't know how to, especially if somebody's more powerful. He was the coach. He was the priest. He was the movie producer. They seem to have so much more power than you have. And so that's part of it. And part of it is that there is a little crazy place inside of you that says, what role did I play in this? Maybe I did something wrong.
Yeah. And you wonder until you're
an
adult, you wonder what was it about me that attracted that sort of attention? Why me?
And it's just, you know, it's just your beauty and your innocence and your, I mean, you still, it's many, many years later, but you are still a very lovely person. And so they see that there are people who see that as a vulnerability, as opposed to something to love and celebrate and protect. They see it as a way in, you know?
Well, you don't feel that way.
No, of course not.
And even as you identify as an adult, you know, being described as lovely is embarrassing because
I certainly didn't mean it that way.
No, but because it's tragic, but you feel the opposite. You feel ugly. You feel tarnished. You feel
but loveliness is to me the ultimate strength. Because when you have the ability to share a story and to share your vulnerability, that's the ultimate strength. The people who are unable to share their vulnerabilities are not strong people because they're afraid. So to me, and that's what I was trying to tell you in the very first phone conversation we had, the beauty of the story you tell and how you're using it now to help other people who've been through this is the ultimate strength, because you're not saying, I need to hide something. Hiding is weakness. Stepping out and sharing is the ultimate strength. And to me, that is loveliness. Loveliness is such a beautiful thing in an individual. And to me, how you have processed what you went through is equally lovely and equally strong. That's a beautiful thing, and you should embrace it that way.
Well,
I know it's hard.
But interesting. What's been really fascinating for me right now is this process. This is a process for me because
sure, it still is. It will be your whole life, probably.
I have literally hundreds of hours interviewing survivors.
Right.
That most of whom are now my clients.
Right.
And initially this took a toll on me as we, you know, started to undertake this type of case.
Right.
Case log.
Because you're hearing things that happened to you.
Yeah. But then, you know, gradually it occurred to me that these stories weren't about me, and I was more involved in experiencing people as they took back their power.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've been an open book with my clients, as I am today. I'm sharing my story.
Right.
I have also been sharing my experience sort of transition, my therapy, what I do to soothe myself,
right.
my spiritual journey.
Yeah.
And one thing that is a recent experience that's mm-hmm. been just compelling for me,
right.
Through my therapy, I have begun to see myself as the man I am mm-hmm. and see the world through the eyes of this man that I've become and not the little boy that was victimized.
Right.
And as I do this, I can imagine the little boy.
Right.
And I imagine the little boy and I can see him the way I would see my own children. I can.
You want to put your arms around
him? Yes.
I know that feeling.
I
know that feeling.
And, you know, sports heroes speak of themselves in the third person and they say, you know, Paul Barr this and what. But it's a lot like that.
Yeah.
And I mean I can smell that little boy's hair. I can feel his cheeks in my hands.
Oh.
And I can feel his pain.
Wow. That's pretty intense. I got to tell you. I so get it, and that is I think what makes you such a remarkable person and such a remarkable advocate for people who have been victimized. It's interesting to me because I look back at what you've done in your life and you first became a firefighter. You have some pretty remarkable stories to tell. And a mutual friend of ours, Dave, who's here in the room with us, Dave Plotkin, told me the story about how you had gone in as a firefighter to rescue some children in a fire and got them out. And then you went back in during the investigation and you noticed these little handprints on the wall. Charcoal sort of handprints from tiny hands trying to find their way out of that building. And I thought, what a remarkable person that you would have even noticed that. Because most people will go in and they're going to do their job to investigate. How did this fire start? So I kind of felt as I thought about you and this, that even at that time in your life, that younger period before you did the whole law journey and teaching and all the other stuff, that you were constantly looking at, and I don't like to, the term victim is kind of a, it has a lot of different weird little fingers to it, because I like to think of us, of all of us, if we go through difficult times, that we have the ability not just to survive, but to thrive in the aftermath. But it's pretty clear that you took on all kinds of jobs that allowed you to help people. And it was like you were looking for a way to help people because you hadn't been helped in that time in your life.
Yeah, I.
Well, maybe you didn't process it that way.
Well, you know, these events in my life, they set you on a trajectory.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in a position where you can only do the next thing.
Right.
So the next thing after the priest and the coach was... Mm-hmm. I was still, you know, really, really yearning for mentorship. I was yearning for some kind of spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a new priest and a new youth group director.
Okay.
Long story longer, it turns out that both of them are notoriously accused of being pedophiles.
Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. How does that happen?
And this is all within the same parish.
Right.
The priest I'm talking about has been reported on wildly in the media and is on the list, and there are numerous victims of his. And the youth group director, there's a website about this youth director who, both of them were so full of charisma.
Right.
And they exploited that charisma. They were the ones, not like the one, the priest earlier that we talked about.
A little quieter, yeah.
Yeah, but these two were just what you would expect. They
sparkling.
Were
sparkling.
And you couldn't help but to be attracted to them.
Right.
And the youth group director took me under his wing, made me his right-hand man. We were like Gilligan and the Skipper.
Wow, don't go there.
Yeah.
Don't wreck that show for me.
Yeah, right. Well, we became something of a cult.
Right.
The way we behaved, the way he communicated with us.
Sure.
And he gave me an inside look at how pedophiles view the world, because he was a man who communicated with children as their equal, as his equal.
Right, right.
And he
treated me very attractive to kids.
Sure.
Did he try to go after you?
He never did.
Okay, good.
But strangely, he would confide in me. Mm-hmm. He shared with me what his attractions were. And asked me to pray for him and with him about this.
Was he looking for a response from you to see if you were interested?
I think he was more looking for someone to justify
what
he was doing, because he was attracted to young girls, little girls.
Oh, okay.
Children.
Okay.
But he would share this with me, and I think he wanted me to say that I had
similar.
And I think then he liked to have something on you.
Yeah.
So if he had something on you, he could keep you quiet.
Right.
So that was his MO. And he stayed involved with children for many years. And I've said many times that if the only reason I became an attorney was to keep him alone, away from children, then it would have been worth all the work I did.
One of the things I want to bring up, because I think it's really fascinating, is that, and I have spoken with people who had been abused as teens, in one person in particular who was abused at a Catholic girls' boarding school, and a terrific person, but she had such distaste and such hatred for the Catholic Church and for the fact that both the school and her family had basically shunned her in the aftermath of her being attacked by a teacher at the school, who, as it turned out, had attacked many other kids. And the interesting thing to me is that you are still lovingly Catholic.
Yes. And I like to say that I'm Catholic with a small c. Mm-hmm. I'm still a member.
You're realistic about it.
I'm the Catholic Church is the term Catholic means universal.
Right. Sure.
But the institutional church, the capital C church, they're not making it easy.
No.
With their secrets.
Right.
And all the many, many ways they have hidden atrocity.
Right.
The woman you describe.
Right.
It's understandable to shun what has damaged you so much.
Yes.
I have a very difficult time attending Mass because I see the priest like anyone else does. I see him as somebody who is complicit. Mm-hmm. Because if he didn't do it, he at least had to have known.
He's supporting an institution that has tried to push it under the rug for centuries.
Yes. And I've had this conversation with priests, who I know quite well, and I've said, I know that you know where the bodies are buried.
Can the church survive this, and how would they?
The church can survive, and the church has survived so much.
Right.
The church deals in centuries, not months and years.
And decades,
So they're playing the long game.
Right.
They're looking down the road to when we're all dead and gone, and the church will still be here. They survived the Inquisition.
Yes.
They've survived so much. Right. So, wars, any number of things, right?
Yeah.
So they'll survive this. I wish I could say that it would survive for its mission of love.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that,
right?
Because in the big picture, that's what it's supposed to be about.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're Christian or not, the message of Christ is a message of love,
right?
And I look to that message. I look to that message, and I try to look beyond the individuals running the institution,
right?
Especially when those individuals are sitting across from me, lying to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you still find spiritual inspiration through the church?
I find spiritual inspiration through the theology that I can read.
Right.
And, you know, it's I'm going to oversimplify this, but, you know, it's not unlike our favorite comedians or our favorite musicians that entertain us,
right?
But whose personal lives have damaged so many people.
Right.
Can I still laugh at those jokes? Can I still appreciate the good things that some of those people have done for their communities?
Right.
not to say we should ignore the harm that those individuals have done, but it doesn't negate the good things that they did.
Right. Do we throw it all away?
That's right.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting point. I think, you know, you can look at everybody from a Harvey Weinstein to a Bill Cosby and say, you know, they produced so many incredible films and television shows and moments to celebrate the beauty and the humor in life. Do we just shut it off and say, we'll never look at any of that again? Or do we say, okay, we realize, you know, and even on a larger sense, I'm a huge history fan. And I am always fascinated by how we deconstruct these days our historic figures. You know, we, for decades, centuries, we have looked at, say, the founding fathers as the statues that we see them as. And now, you know, as we begin to understand their history and who they were as fallible human beings, we see their downside. We see the, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and all of sort of the craziness of their personal lives. And, but do we just let go of what they created and what they gave us? You know, that's a hard question.
You know, these are people that created what we call democracy, mm-hmm. but they're also people that promoted one of the most horrific institutions, slavery,
right?
And what that all was. And it wasn't democracy for everyone, but their concepts and what people fought and die and still people fight and die for are both real.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to really understand is that a lot of, we haven't talked about this, but a lot of the people that I meet with mm-hmm. have been abused by people in their own families.
Yeah.
And Christmas still comes, Thanksgiving still comes, and they still attend these events.
Sit around the table together.
And they're, you know, across from them are the very people who abuse them. They attend funerals together.
What do you think about that? What do you tell them when they come to you and they say, I feel like a hypocrite because I sit on the other side of the turkey, you know, from this person that has done this to me? What can you say to them? Because you know, you feel what that means because on some level you had to continue. Maybe you didn't go to church right away, but you still went back at some point. What do you tell them? How do you tell them to deal with that part of it?
I don't know.
I don't know what I'd tell them.
You know, I have, you know, I'm the first person in my family to have attended college. So I'm the person who is asked to deliver the eulogy at most of the funerals, and I have had to stand up and find something positive to say about people that I love, but who hurt me deeply as a child.
Right.
And, you know, there are moments and there are moments.
Right.
So we pick our moments.
Yeah.
And I say, protect yourself. Mm-hmm. I say, you own this story. So you tell your story where and when and to whom you want to.
Right.
It's your story. That's what I tell them.
And that moment when they are able to stand up and face either the individual or the institution in court and say, this is what happened to me. And you need to on some very insignificant level, make some kind of a restitution. That must empower them on some level. Maybe not completely. Maybe there's a lot of other healing that needs to take place.
I think just knowing that they own that story.
Right.
I heard a story about a woman who at her father's wake, mm-hmm. as they greeted the people who came through the line, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. And the woman's response was, my father molested me, to every person.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that that's the right or the wrong or
she
the what thing, but
for
that
her,
was,
she needed that moment.
That was her story.
Yeah.
She owned it. And
there's no follow up to that, you know, because it is her story.
Yeah.
So, wow. Did she say that that made her feel better?
I don't know. I mean, there are a million family dynamics that go with that. And that's why everyone, your hair goes back when you hear that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the fallout was. I don't know if she regrets having done it. But
were you ever able to speak to your mother about what, you know, because I'm sure that you loved her and she loved you. Were you ever able to address what happened and her follow up?
No, my mother died when she was 50.
Oh,
and I was 24.
So, yeah, that discussion wouldn't have taken place that quickly.
Yeah, no, she passed very young. And my father, who lived until he was 75, mm-hmm. but never knew any of this.
Never, even until he died. Okay.
No, never knew.
Okay.
And you know, my father did not have the complexity, I don't think, to really digest this.
Right, right.
So I didn't burden him with it.
Right.
For good or bad, I don't know, because he's been gone 10 years. I've had 10 more years to wonder what kind of conversation we'd be having today if he were still here.
I have to say. I know you say you were adopted. It begs the question, where did you come from? Have you ever looked into that?
I have very, yes, which could be the subject for two more podcasts.
Right, yeah.
But I did find my birth mother uh-huh. when I was 24.
Right.
I found my birth mother. I found some records after my adopted. My mom died. Right. We call it, you know, your mom's your mom that you raised you. Right.
Right.
So my mom passed and I found some records and I found my original birth certificate. And before the computers made things easy, I was able to go to the library and
look it up.
Obituaries. And it took several months, but I tracked her down. We arranged to meet. When we did, we had this conversation. It says, you know, you're a grandmother. Mm-hmm. I said, I have two daughters. Then I had two daughters. I have four children now, but at the time I had two daughters. Mm-hmm. And I said, one is only a couple months old and the other one is three. And she said, oh, well, your new daughter, when's her birthday? And it was December 4th. Mm-hmm. She goes, interesting. She goes, you know, my niece was born December, her niece mm-hmm. from the other side of the family was born December 3rd. And we talked about hospital and they were born in the same hospital.
Wow. Same year?
Same, yeah, a day apart. So then as we're talking, her eyes got really big and she goes, oh my God. She goes, we met. I was in the hospital visiting my niece and we were together standing at the glass looking at the babies. And it was the day my daughter, her granddaughter, was born.
Wow.
And we were talking and she goes, I remember they both had reddish hair. And
the universe put you together.
She saw her granddaughter. The day she was born.
Wow.
And she recalled it and she remembered me. Yeah. Yeah.
How fascinating is that?
Did
you stay in touch with her or?
For 10-ish years before she passed. Another of my relatives who died young. And she told me who she thought the father was. Turns out now in the age of ancestry.com.
Right. Exactly.
I learned that the person I thought was my biological father was not.
Wow.
And I was able to learn
who he is.
Who he is or was and right.
He's gone.
He's gone too. Uh-huh. So yeah, all of my next generation relatives have passed.
Is that satisfying to you to know, at least know who they were?
Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, Niagara Falls is a sort of microcosm of New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very ethnic.
Yeah.
And I learned that I'm 50% European Jewish, mm-hmm. which I know very little of.
Right.
And
right.
I've been reading constantly ever since.
You were a good Catholic boy.
I was a good Catholic boy.
Yeah.
So I'm learning a lot about what that means. And it's just fascinating. And
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
you see
really
all
is.
The colors. And, wow. What a story. You're a movie. You're a book. You really are. You really, because, you know, and I said this to you the first time I spoke with you, the beauty of who you are is that you took all of these experiences and you turned them into positives. You became a firefighter who rescued people. You became a teacher who taught children who were at risk. What you it says children at risk in your bio. What does that mean?
Well, I became a firefighter when I was 22. Mm-hmm. I was married when I was 20, and it was kind of as the result of the cult that we talked about.
Sure, sure.
My then wife and I were having our first child and realized that we weren't playing house, that this was real.
Right. Yeah. It's very young.
And then I needed a job.
Right.
So I became a firefighter.
Right.
And I didn't realize how much I'd love doing that until I was there.
Right.
But I also learned that there was such an opportunity to do other things while you're a firefighter because there's time.
Right.
There's the way the shifts work and the time you spend in the firehouse, you can study.
Right. You're not a couch potato type, I guess.
No, and I right away, I immersed myself in collecting credentials.
Wow.
And I got my bachelor's degree in teaching and I began working with students, as they say, at risk. But I actually described them in an application to law school as not at risk, because whatever they were at risk for had happened to them.
Right. Right.
These were children that that I learned some
they
of them
faced risk.
Well, they were homeless.
Yeah.
I had children that were homeless. I had children who brought weapons to school. I was threatened with weapons several times.
Sure, because they don't. That's their life. That's what they know.
Yes, and they were the students who were not allowed on school property,
right?
And because of their violent behavior at school.
Yeah.
And you know, we found I had a partner, another firefighter who worked the opposite shift, so we would more or less pass in the hall at both jobs.
Right, right.
And we found a way to work with these kids that it wasn't all academic. It was a lot of different things.
Mentoring, sort of helping them figure out.
We sent a kid to summer camp.
Yeah.
All these years later, some of them are still in touch with me.
Oh.
You know, a couple get out of jail now and then and drop in to see me.
Everybody's looking for strength. They're looking for a rock in their lives. We all are. We all need somebody who makes us feel like, okay, whatever I'm going through, it's going to be okay. And so you provided that for them. And you do for your clients now who have faced what they've faced and are just looking for some sense of, you know what, I can regain my strength. I can come back from this at least to a certain extent.
Yeah, and you're taking me back to that man that can talk to that little boy that was me all those years ago. And it takes me to the rage I feel at my church that's supposed to be that.
Right, they're supposed to be the rock.
They're supposed to be. That's what Jesus said
to
Peter.
That's exactly, I am the rock.
You are the rock upon whom I will build my church.
Right.
Well, the church is not behaving
like a rock.
Like the rock.
No.
I vacillate, you know, between rage.
But you are providing a rock for people. You may not see it that way exactly, but you know, you're providing a solid place for people to say, okay, in this little area, I can begin to regain my sense of strength and my ability to look forward to my life in a way that I can respond to what people have, you know, people or institutions have done to me and say, this isn't right. I'm going to take this back. I'm going to take my strength back. So you're giving them that. So, you know, God bless you.
Thank you. Yeah. I was asked by a reporter recently, do you have to have been a survivor of this sort of thing in order to connect with people and to represent them? And I said, well, no, you don't have to. I said, I'm the right person for a lot of people that I've met. But what's important is that people find the right person.
That they reach out and say, I'm going to take this back.
You don't have to, you know, I have a terrific therapist. And he says to me sometimes, I asked him, how do you do this day in and day out?
I have asked my therapist the same thing.
How do you listen to these?
I don't know how you do that. I want to hold you. I feel bad for you.
Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm triggered sometimes by the things my clients say to me.
Sure, of course you are.
And he says, well, I'm not. He said, I had a happy childhood. I didn't have all these experiences that you've described in your life. So I can hear.
Compartmentalize it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I may not be the right person for everybody,
right.
but if people hear either the radio ad that I have or this conversation, mm-hmm. and it inspires them to, if not reach out to me, reach out to somebody,
right,
and take back their power, is the expression we keep using, then this is all worthwhile. Then it's all good stuff that we're doing.
Oh, it's all worthwhile. I'm sure it is. Because you touch people and you help them, and we talked about this, go from being a survivor to being a thriver, which you have, clearly. And that doesn't mean that the job is done. It just means that the trajectory is towards thriving, towards reclaiming the things that somebody tried to take away from you or them. You know, what more can we ask for? That's what life is all about. It's a continual learning process, you know.
Yeah.
Bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. And I am going to hug you.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.